Welcome to the Left of Lansing podcast with your host, Pat Johnston. A progressive insight into Michigan's political and cultural world. A, dare we say, entertaining podcast designed to shine a light on how we can best make Michigan's political machine work for the people. And now, live from the Left of Lansing headquarters, located in his attic, here's Pat Johnston.
Yeah! Welcome to another edition of the Left of Lansing podcast. I'm your host, Pat Johnston. Yes, I'm still here. Sorry, I've been away for a while. Other things made me a bit busy of late, but I'm always keeping up to date on what's happening here in Michigan and throughout the rest of the nation. And you can read some of my thoughts at leftoflansing.com. Plus, follow me on Twitter at leftoflansing, and I'm also available on the Facebook as well. Coming up shortly, I'll talk with award-winning journalist Anna Clark. Anna has written a critically acclaimed book on the Flint water crisis, and the book is called The Poison City, Flint Water, and the American Urban Tragedy. We'll talk not only about the events that led up to the crisis and the subsequent cover-up, but how Flint is just one of many American cities suffering through decades of deliberate racial and economic policies that set these cities up for failure. It's time that we reverse that trend, and quickly, my friends. So coming up in just a few moments, I'll be speaking with Anna Clark. On the next podcast, I will have more to say on the budget process that is happening here in Michigan, and it's not looking good at the moment, LOLers. I'm sorry, but despite across-the-board victories for Democrats in statewide races and state legislative victories, even with all of the Michigan Republican gerrymandering, the Republican-led legislature is pretending like it won the election of 2018, and in some ways, I feel like Democrats sort of helped Republicans win this round. It's unbelievable, but it's kind of true. Like I said, I'll have more to say in the next podcast once we find out how Governor Whitmer is going to deal with this disastrous GOP budget. But first, I'd like to say a quick word of thank you to Michigan Democratic Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib. Tlaib, of course, is part of what's known as the Squad in Washington, which consists also of Minnesota's Ilhan Omar, Ayanna Pressley of Massachusetts, and New York City's AOC. If you recall, Tlaib caused a fake controversy when she said the night that she was formally sworn in Congress that she'd fight hard to impeach the MFR. So you'll remember now that the Washington press became verklempt. Oh, so verklempt when Rashida Tlaib made her pronouncement back then in January. I mean, they covered that story incessantly, don't you remember? I mean, they demanded other Democrats denounce that freshman Democrat for her lack of decorum. Even Mitch Albom lectured Tlaib in his Detroit Free Press column, saying, "A new low in a cesspool of human relations we call politics, and to not acknowledge that is to indirectly condone it, especially since Tlaib is from our backyard, Detroit, and more especially since she defended her comments by saying that's how people in our city speak." Now, Albom's dissertation in decorum continued as he disagreed with Tlaib's assertion that that's how plain-spoken Detroiters talk. "We don't," said Mitch Albom. "Calling someone a mother effer isn't colorful, it's profane. It's not interesting, it's lazy. And it's not really how many of us want the rest of the country to view our vocabulary here in the Motor City. And since Tlaib's title is representative, I'm disappointed she didn't know that." Mitch was disappointed while fanning himself to prevent some fainting. Oh my, oh my, oh my. I guess Mitch Albom was not a fan of George Carlin. I'm sorry, everybody, but we live in different times. The Washington, D.C. press created Donald Trump, and it wants to act like it had nothing to do with Donald Trump's presidency or Donald Trump becoming president. And they want to act like this is something they never saw coming. That's a complete canard. It gave. I mean, that press corps gave clowns like Rush Limbaugh, Don Imus, Laura Ingraham, and countless other rich white folk airtime and print space so they could air their grievances on the difficulties of living in the 1%. The Washington Press Corps hates people like Rashida Tlaib. or AOC. They hate them because they stand for those who've been told to sit down for decades, for centuries. They don't like that because they don't view people like Tlaib or AOC as one of them. They mock people like Rashida Tlaib. They mock somebody like AOC, especially AOC, because remember, you know, she was a bartender. They want us to believe that saying impeach the MF-er is a line that we just can't cross, while the press forced us to watch hours upon hours upon hours of Trump campaign coverage in which he used curse words repeatedly so as to appear as a straight shooter, to appear as a guy who battles those pesky PC police nerds. In fact, it even got to the point in one debate that we were talking about hand size. Decorum died in 2016, and Democrats must fight fire with fire, and that is one thing that a Detroiter like Rashida Tlaib knows too well. Again, Rashida Tlaib told America what had to be done months ago, but many Democrats resisted. They resisted the resistance. Go figure. But this latest story, thanks to a whistleblower, has brought everyone from the Michigan Democratic House membership to Tlaib's side. Michigan Congresswoman Alyssa Slotkin, one of the National Security Democrats in the House, joined a handful of other House Democrats in penning an op-ed in the Washington Post this week explaining why it's time for her to back an impeachment inquiry. She said, "The president of the United States may have used his position to pressure a foreign country into investigating a political opponent, and he sought to use U.S. taxpayer dollars as leverage to do it. He allegedly sought to use the very security assistance dollars appropriated by Congress to create stability in the world, to help root out corruption, and to protect our own national security interests for his own personal gain. These allegations are stunning, both in the national security threat they pose and the potential corruption they represent. We also know that on September 9th, the Inspector General for the Intelligence Community notified Congress of a credible and urgent whistleblower complaint related to national security and potentially involving these allegations. Despite federal law requiring the disclosure of this complaint to Congress, the administration has blocked its release to Congress." Now, of course, that was a few days ago. Now, of course, that complaint has been released along with the rough transcript of that phone call. It's not a verbatim transcript, just a rough transcript. And for some reason, those in the Trump administration and his defenders thought that the rough transcript was going to help. How? It made things worse. Look, I've had my issues with Alyssa Slotkin, as I've said here on the podcast at times. But as I've also said many times, I'd much rather have Alyssa Slotkin in Congress than the alternative. Of course I would. Let me just say this, Congresswoman Slotkin, better late than never, I suppose. Welcome aboard. And let's give a round of applause to Michigan Congresswoman Haley Stevens for joining the fight as well this week. But we cannot forget that it was Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib who pushed for impeachment from day one. She is a proud Detroiter who doesn't back down from a fight. And while that angers the extreme right-wing Republican Party and even some so-called moderates in her own party, Tlaib follows in the true tradition of progressivism by making opponents feel uncomfortable because the truth makes them feel uncomfortable. Meanwhile, the Republican Party is AWOL. They relinquished power to Trump and the extreme evangelical movement, and we cannot rely on any of them to do the right thing at this time. It's time to stand and fight for principle. You can't say Trump is a threat to this country's well-being, but do nothing to change it. So again, thanks to the leadership of Detroiter Rashida Tlaib and other progressive House Democrats and progressive activists too, more and more Democrats are reading the tea leaves and have finally decided that enough is enough. They finally decided to join in the fight. One more note. As Nancy Caffer, columnist for the Detroit Free Press, wrote this week, she said, "When we say civility, often the tool we really mean to invoke is empathy. When another human is angry, we should ask why. Understanding, honoring, and recognizing the anger that many of Tlaib's constituents feel, the anger of Americans who have not historically been allowed to be angry, the anger that prompts us to do something may be the best way to win." You're listening to LOL.
It's the Left of Lansing podcast with Pat Johnston. Rumor has it, if you want to get Pat really fired up, just tell him Ringo Starr is just an average drummer. And don't forget to visit leftoflansing.com for more news and information. Now, back to Pat.
You can always email me. Very simple, leftoflansing@gmail.com. That's leftoflansing@gmail.com. I have to admit, this is an interview that I've been wanting to conduct ever since I started this little venture months ago, back in the wintertime. I've talked about the Flint water crisis, as many of you have known, on this podcast many times, because it really did upset me, and I know it upset many Michiganders. It was a man-made tragedy that should have never happened. Not only that, but it's a tragedy that was covered up for months while Flint residents, you know, who are American citizens, Flint residents, you know, who live in an American city, drank poisoned water while our state government did nothing to stop it. Still to this date, no one related to this crisis has been brought to justice, and the governor who oversaw this tragedy unfold is now enjoying his post-political career, living a carefree life, knowing the chances of being held accountable for the poisoning of children, Michigan children, are slim to none. Anna Clark is a journalist who resides in Detroit. She has written for a number of news publications through the years, most recently in the New York Times. But she also wrote a book about this scandal that's called The Poison City, Flint Water, and the American Urban Tragedy. It's a book that not only gives a detailed account of the events that led to the crisis, but also how through years and years of debilitating policies, cities like Flint are designed to fail. It's a book I would recommend everyone to read, because even if you think you know everything about the Flint water crisis, trust me, Anna Clark will prove you wrong. It's my pleasure to introduce award-winning journalist and author Anna Clark to the Left of Lansing podcast. Welcome. And thank you for being on, Anna.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. That was a very generous introduction.
You've been a Michigander for most of your life, is that correct?
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. I grew up in Southwest Michigan. I went to school in Ann Arbor, lived in Boston for a few years, but got to Detroit in 2007, where I've largely been since.
What brought you back to Detroit?
Honestly, as much as I was fond in many ways of Boston, I wanted to live in a city that was the exact opposite of Boston. And I had a good friend who was here, and that was kind of enough for me to just make the leap and come try this place out. And especially when I got there in 2007, it was the beginning of a challenging few years, and it took me a little while to get acquainted with not just the city, but the region. But I've never really left either, you know? I mean, it's a place that does hook you in.
I want to get into your book here in just a moment, but how did your childhood experiences of living in St. Joseph drive you to someday become like this hard-hitting journalist and writer that you are today?
Well, I guess I kind of have two answers to that. In one way, like, I grew up loving reading and writing very early on. It was especially fiction. That was my first love, which sounds like the opposite of journalism. You know, it's about imagined worlds rather than true worlds. But early on, I got a strong attachment to writing as a way to explore my imagination and the world around me. And I was fortunate enough to have adults in my life who supported that, who encouraged me in that, helped me to think it was possible to be a writer, which is really important. And this is not a world where it's easy to be a writer, and especially a journalist these days. And I'm really grateful that I got a grounding that helped me make it so. So that was one piece. The other piece that I think stayed with me early on was growing up in I grew up in St. Joseph. It's right next to the town of Benton Harbor, and the two cities are often written about as like complete opposites, you know, one whiter and wealthier and one poorer and largely African-American. Alex Kotlowitz wrote a book about our communities that came out when I was in high school. And I remember reading it with such heat and mixed feelings because it's a small community. You know everybody. All my friends' parents is who appeared in the book. And it's tough to have somebody you don't know and from outside the area tell you things about where you come from. But the fact is, a lot of it was true. The segregated dynamic there is incredibly strange. I felt very defensive about it because though I grew up in St. Joe, had a lot of roots in Benton Harbor and grew up in a poor family. And, you know, I wanted to be like, it's more complicated than the way that people simplify it. anyway, the point is, I think growing up in a place that felt where a lot of inequalities were very visible and that a place that was scrutinized often by outsiders, I think that was part of the fuel that led me to choose journalism as the way to try to understand places, people, and inequality.
You know, I want to thank you for getting into some more detail about the St. Joseph Benton Harbor dichotomy. I kind of set that up for you because I remember an op-ed that you wrote in the Detroit Free Press last June as Democratic Governor Gretchen Whitmer was considering closing Benton Harbor High School due to debt and also low academic performance, I believe. The state of Michigan, I believe, has reached a deal to keep the school open while establishing some sort of committee to work with Benton Harbor school officials on developing a long-term plan to keep the school open. As you said, St. Joseph and Benton Harbor, they are right next to each other, separated by, you know, a river. However, you know, that economic divide is wider and wider between the two towns. In your piece, titled Two Michigan Cities Are Steps Apart, but Inequality Between Them Runs Deep, you wrote, and if you don't mind, I'm just going to read here for a quick second. Benton Harbor is pushing hard against closure, but in the meantime, students are absorbing hurtful words about their intelligence and their parents' love. It makes them wary of going to school in a neighboring district if your own school is indeed closed. They don't want us, residents say. Whatever happens with Benton Harbor High School, people in St. Joseph and other area communities have an opportunity to interrupt this pattern of history. Instead of treating Benton Harbor youth as threats or charity cases, they might say, in words and deeds, we value you. We believe in your future. We will back you up in your fight for great local schools. If it comes to the point where you need another place to get your education, it would be our great honor to invest in you. But no matter what, you have a home here too. Anna, do you find it difficult sometimes to get this obvious point across of the racial inequalities sometimes? And like you said, with Benton Harbor and St. Joe's, and it's a point that I just, for some reason, I sometimes find difficult getting across to people that some poor towns have been dealt a rotten hand due to years and years of policies that set these towns up for failure. Does it feel like that you're pushing against a brick wall to get that point across to some people?
It absolutely is a challenge. I mean, it's not a story that's told often or well or enough. You know, the way that our history of creating separate and unequal cities was very purposeful. You know, it didn't happen by accident. When we look around us and see 50 years after major triumphant civil rights laws were passed, we look around us and we can still see that we're by and large pretty segregated by race and class. You know, like, I mean, that's not an accident. I mean, we set our housing policies, our economic policies, we set systems up so that even on their own momentum, they kind of just replicate the inequalities that were put there on purpose in the beginning, regardless of the intentions of the people now, like regardless of any individual homeowners, you know, personal feelings about, you know, human rights or racism or anything like that. I mean, it's something that I think that is worth, you know, I mean, talking about. I'm glad you have this podcast. I try to do it in my writing. I know there are a lot of people who just personally try to tell these stories because I don't know, like the us versus them dynamic has been like a toxic element in how we've organized ourselves from the very beginning. And if we're going to change that, we really got to get past that dynamic. We got to start seeing how our communities are interconnected, even when they seem very separate and different. You know, the cause and effect is related. I really have heard constantly, both as a kid and as an adult, that the Benton Harbor's problems were just related to people there just not caring enough. And I think that's really, it's really upsetting. Like, it's because, I mean, I almost, you know, there's almost a kind of idealism based in that, like the fact that it's just a matter of failure of local leadership and failure of parenting, that like it's almost like individualizing the problem makes it simpler, you know, and maybe easier to digest. But the fact is that's just not true. There are like really wonderful people and parents and leaders in Benton Harbor. There are some, I love St. Joe, but like there are some terrible leaders and parents in there too, you know, but there's reasons why the communities look as different as they do, that go beyond their individual borders.
We're speaking with Anna Clark, author of The Poison City, Flint's Water, and The American Urban Tragedy, here on the Left of Lansing podcast. I ask these questions of racial inequality that you've written about in other pieces because let's face it, that's one of your main themes in your book here on the Flint water crisis. Is that one reason why you decided to write such a detailed account to what led here to the crisis in Flint?
Yes, I mean, and yes, in many ways. You know, as a journalist in my adult life and being rooted here in Detroit, I've spent a lot of years writing articles that deal with the problems of disinvested cities, certainly the historical context, but also what pragmatically can we do about it now? You know, like, would that the history of bad decisions didn't happen, but they have, and here we are, so now what, right? Articles I've reported and have dealt with, like Detroit's bankruptcy and our own emergency management years, our own infrastructure problems with water and vacancy and all that. All these problems that like had a connection, had a parallel with what happened in Flint. So when I started writing articles about what was going on with Flint's water crisis, it was helpful to not come in cold to a lot of the challenges that they were facing, because familiar with how it's a pattern in Michigan's disinvested cities. And it was pretty clear early on that even in longer articles, there was a lot more to the story than you could include to tell a complete story. I mean, Flint had a really surreal spotlight on it for a while. It seemed like everybody was talking about and telling stories about Flint, some great, some terrible. It got very confusing in that noise, right? And even folks who paid attention and care about it and live nearby to this day are kind of like, wait, what happened in Flint again? Something with the water, right? Like, I know it was bad, but, you know, not really knowing the story behind it. So what I hoped with the book was to bring some clarity to what we're talking about when we talk about, quote, the Flint water crisis, while also putting in context of the larger American story about our cities, about how we approach urban policy, how we approach cities, the ways we built inequality into them in a manner that doesn't match, I think, our American ideals, and what we can do about it, because we can do something about it. Our choices turn out to be very powerful in a democracy.
Did you also, because I look at it this way too, while there is a racial aspect to it, a component to it, no doubt about it, did you also look at it as more, I guess, a wealth inequality story as well as a racial?
Both overlapping at the same time, intersecting for sure. With Flint, like, there's a lot of reasons to think about why a really disastrous switch happened in the first place. But even after the fact, you know, there's a lot of self-reflection that I think has gone on in the state about why it took so long, a year and a half, before people took the complaints of people in the community seriously. Not just public officials, but state officials, of course, but also other universities, other environmental groups, other journalists, including myself. And I think when considering why people in this community were not being taken seriously, even when they did everything any reasonable person would do to get their concerns about this escalating water crisis heard, you can't get past the fact that poor people in this country, and also people of color, are not credited for having authority even over the matters of their own lives. And put those two together, and I think that had a direct result on how this water crisis played out. And frankly, also, I would say gerrymandering. With Flint being a poor, largely people of color community, and having fewer representatives in the state that were of their political party, you know, I think there are fewer people who felt they had a stake in listening to what this community had to say.
We're speaking with Anna Clark, who is the author of The Poison City, Flint's Water, and the American Urban Tragedy, here on the podcast this week. We're kind of talking in broad themes about the Flint water crisis. I was wondering if you wouldn't mind maybe just reminding some people exactly why did Flint residents switch from water that they got from the Detroit Water Authority to the Flint River? How did that all come about?
Really good question. So Flint had been a customer of Detroit's water department, like a huge, huge public utility serving nearly half of Michigan's residents. They'd been a customer of them for nearly 50 years, drawing water from Lake Huron. And it had some complaints with the Detroit's water department, but the quality was good. That was consistently solid. There had been internal conversations in the city for many years about what their long-term water situation was going to be. Should they stick with Detroit and sign another long-term contract? Should they build their own pipeline? Should they try the Flint River? You know, it had been talked about for a while, but the real switch happened when Flint, while under emergency management, decided it was going to leave Detroit's water system to join a brand new water authority called the KWA, the Karagandhi Water Authority. But the Karagandhi Water Authority wasn't yet built. It wasn't going to be ready to go for like 2 years or so from when Flint wanted to leave Detroit. So to fill the gap, the city under emergency management decided to reboot their old plant on the Flint River and use it to treat water from the Flint River. The idea was they would do this for a couple of years. When the KWA is in operation, they'll switch on to them, and where they would again get Lake Huron water, though they would be treating it themselves at their own plant. That was the plan. It unfortunately did not go well.
The officials decided to do this. And by the way, when we say officials, city officials were behind this, right?
So many were. I mean, it was heated and controversial. I mean, there was a lot of people with a lot of different opinions, but the city council didn't have any power. So it's important to put an asterisk on this.
Yes.
But they were convened to do a vote about should we join the KWA or not. And this was an important question. It was the long-term water future of the city, and it was going to commit Flint to $80 million in debt to finance the construction of this brand new thing. So pretty big question to put before the city. So the emergency manager was the only one who had the authority here, but they sort of voluntarily did a city council vote here, and most of them voted to, yes, go on with the KWA. What there is no record of is of the city council voting for a Flint River interim solution. That's not on the table. That was entirely under the emergency manager.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And I always think that's where a lot of people, especially those who don't live in Michigan, that's where they were always getting confused too, because I remember getting questions from people saying, didn't I see the council's hands raise to vote mm-hmm. for the Flint River? Is like, no, they didn't vote for that. They mm-hmm. voted just for the KWA hookup. However, it didn't matter in the end because they did not have any power. That was taken out of their hands because former Governor Rick Snyder put an emergency manager into place. I would like you just to kind of cover that real quick if you can. The emergency manager, it was a law. And then I believe, if I'm not mistaken, right back in 2012, Michiganders voted to repeal that law. But then the state legislature kind of recreated the emergency manager position. Is that correct?
Yeah, this is such a weird story. It's so bizarre. When I go out of state and tell this, like, I think they think I'm making it up, but I'm really not. So lots of states, Michigan isn't unusual for having some system of state oversight for distressed cities and school districts. Lots of places do that. But Michigan, it was 2010, like expanded its state oversight law in an unusually big way. So there was a lower bar for what it would take to assign an emergency manager to a community. And also they had more authority than ever before, not just taking on the authority that would otherwise be held by a mayor and city council, but additional authorities besides that no elected official has. There was a statewide referendum to repeal that. A lot of people thought that seemed like we're getting dangerously undemocratic here. And Michigan, by a very wide margin, like all over the state, including communities that have never had a community under emergency management, all over the state, soundly rejected.
Right.
Soundly rejected this emergency manager expansion. That was like in November 2012. You have a good memory. And then in the lame duck session that came shortly after, the Michigan legislature put into place basically the exact same law, except this time it had some money attached to it, some appropriations attached to it, which was all they needed to do to make it immune from a second referendum. So we rejected the law, then Michigan lawmakers put the law back on the books, but made it impossible for us to overturn it again as voters. The thinking, the speculation around this is that they felt so urgent about it because they felt like it was essential to have this law in place as Detroit was getting ready to go into bankruptcy, as they expected Detroit to go into bankruptcy. They wanted an emergency manager in Detroit at the time that happened. But of course, it wasn't only Detroit that ended up getting an EM that had such large powers. And this law is still on the books. That's worth mentioning, too, even in the wake of Flint, where we got to see the consequences of little accountability, lack of checks and balances, all that. Even when the Governor Snyder's own commission cited the emergency manager law as it currently stands as a contributing factor to the Flint water crisis, it is to date so far unreformed, though there have been some movement recently in the legislature with some proposals to maybe modify it. But like for now, it's still on the books as it has been since that lame duck session.
So upsetting. So much for Power to the People. We're speaking with Anna Clark, author of The Poison City, Flint's Water, An American Urban Tragedy, here on the Left of Lansing podcast. I can't believe how much time has already flown by. I think we could do like 5 podcasts on this. I just wanted to bring this one point up because it really struck a nerve with me when I was reading your book. I mean, this was all done. The switch to KWA, but the switch to the Flint River while this other pipeline was to be built, it was done all under the guise to save money, to save Flint money, to save the city money. But residents weren't saving money anyway once it switched over to the Flint River. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think this is one of the mysteries about this water story that is in many ways, I think there are still good questions to be asked. I mean, absolutely, the narrative was that by making this switch, we're going to benefit the city long term. You know, we'll have more control over our own water. The idea being like that will make it possible for us to, you know, have more affordable rates. And this was a big deal because the Flint community was paying some of the most expensive water bills in the entire nation, even before you get to the fact that it's disproportionately poor community. They were super expensive water bills. So there was a spate of shutoffs and with people who couldn't afford them. It was a real big problem. Affordability was a big issue. So when it was sort of suggested that this is one way to kind of get a handle of these rising rates, you know, that did bring a lot of people on board. But even before we get to any of the problems with how the water was treated, but like the emergency manager shortly after the switch signed a 2-year budget for the city, of course, that he had unilateral power on, and it included double-digit increases for each of those 2 years on their water rates, even before anything had gone wrong. So the idea being, you know, they were switching to this new water system, but their water rates were going up even so. And the city was a broke city, had gone into $80 million into debt to pay for something it already had anyway, which was water from Lake Huron, except now they were going to have to treat it themselves. So when you get to the idea of like this was saving the city money, whether it's we're talking about the city budget, their debts, or we're talking about individuals and their water rates, it doesn't totally make sense to me right now. It seems very mysterious.
So the switch happened on April of 2014, correct?
That's right.
Okay. Mm-hmm. How long did it take for residents to first report that they were discovering some problems with the water?
The first complaints that were on the record that people reached out to state officials or even in one case the EPA to just kind of record their concerns were just a few weeks later, just a couple of weeks later. People were like, something's weird about this. And to be completely fair, if you're going to switch a new water supply, there's probably going to be some complaints anyway, just because the water really does taste different and it is a little bit different. It is different. It's different water. So some of that might have been ordinary and would have happened anyway. But the thing is with Flint, like those concerns didn't just drop away. They started escalating. They started getting to be more problems, more concerns with more people. There was by August, so the switch was April 2014, by August, there was a series of like boil water advisories because of bacterial contamination. And by October, so like what, 5 months, 6 months after the water switch, the water had become so damaging to the parts at a General Motors engine plant that the engine plant had to leave the city water system entirely and hook onto a suburb's water. The water was corroding its parts. It was rusting them, and they couldn't do their work. They tried trucking in water from Detroit. They tried diluting Flint's water with some other stuff. It was totally unsustainable. So this major corporation made a big move to totally switch its water system to a neighboring community just 5 to 6 months after the water switch. You know, and you think that would have been enough
exactly
to get people to go like, what is going on?
Right,
you know,
right.
If we're not even going to take the concerns of these individuals seriously, this huge multinational corporation has like vouched for what they're saying. Maybe we should take some action here. But it would be yet another year before the state could really conceded that it was a problem.
Why do you think the state was so, I mean, I know there are so many factors. I don't know. This could go on and on and on and on. But I mean, even with residents telling the emergency manager, I think it was Ambrose, correct? Like one of them, a couple of them were bringing their water. And he looked at him and said, that's not your water. And he didn't want to believe it at all. What is their defense? What are some of these state officials with the Department of Environmental Quality and these emergency managers? They knew something was going on, but yet they were still telling everybody, despite some E. coli being detected here or there, despite some other tests showing that the water is contaminated, don't worry, everything's fine.
Yeah, like you said, I think there truly are a lot of reasons. And I think, and I've thought a lot about this, it's just, of course, I'm speculating to a certain extent, but I think some of it is kind of like what we were talking before. It's easier to believe that individual people are terrible than that there's a larger pattern that involves a more complicated, bigger public-oriented solution. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Instead of understanding the complex problem, it's easier to boil things down to, well, this person's just crazy. That's a much easier solution to that. You can just ignore them. I think there's some institutional barriers, right? You know, there's, if you're working for the state environmental or public health agencies, you didn't go into that job because you wanted to hurt people. You're probably generally a good-hearted person who wants a healthy environment and healthy people out there. Everybody you're working around, your colleagues, people you respect, your bosses and all that, and they're all saying, everything's fine, everything's fine. Even if, you know, you're seeing some red flags, maybe you feel uncomfortable about speaking up, contradicting these people you've known and feel loyal to and all that, especially once these agencies are putting themselves on the line publicly saying that the water is safe. Being a whistleblower is a hard thing to do, you know, especially if you actually care about and like the people you work with. I think the fact that this was meant to be a temporary solution worked against the residents in Flint. I think there are people, even when the problems got increasingly undeniable, I think there are people who thought they could just sort of kick the can down the road, eventually switch on to the KWA. And it wouldn't have been true that everything would have been fine then, but I think they believed it might have been fine then. Hmm. We don't really want to do a big solution now if we're just going to switch on to this other source in a year. When it comes to why the water was not treated appropriately, this was breaking federal law. They didn't treat it with something called corrosion control, which is what broke down the pipes and contaminated the water. The environmental agency folks were kind of defending themselves to the EPA, even before this was all public, you know, when the EPA was kind of calling them on it, and they're like, you guys, you're supposed to treat it this way. Why aren't you doing this? And the DEQ was saying that they had a different read of the law. They said that they didn't think that they needed to do it. They only needed to monitor it. You know, I mean, they presented it as, we have a different interpretation of the law. But of course, EPA has authority over them,
right, you know, right,
to interpret that law. And also, every single water person I've ever talked to, when it comes to this particular treatment that the water is supposed to receive, everybody, it's a basic piece. Nobody thinks that there's a reasonable other interpretation of the law that I've heard from outside of Michigan's environmental agency.
So was the EPA wrong in not pressing the State Department of Environmental Quality?
Yeah, I think that was one of their things. I mean, the EPA, among the figures who could have done something different, the EPA had some serious self-reflection to do. They had a whole inspector general report about why they didn't intervene sooner in Flint. And the good news is that there was one guy at the EPA who went truly out of his way to monitor what was going on in Flint and wrote the first official draft report that showed how this was not just a problem at an individual's house, but a citywide problem. And that's what really started getting things going and forcing a response here. His colleagues at the EPA didn't fully have his back, unfortunately. And so they didn't follow through as they might have. And I think this is a little bit my personal speculation. I think judging by the communications back and forth, you know, and internally with the EPA that have come out since, it seems like the EPA was almost a little fretful of appearing like the big heavy in this situation. I think they kept wanting to be like, let's find a collaborative solution and let's try to work this out, and, you know, deferring to the Michigan agencies whenever they could. And, you know, like, I mean, we live in an era where people are very suspicious of big federal agencies and regulations and all that. And I think they're trying to tone themselves down in every way so as not to, I don't know, appear hostile or something.
Yeah.
But the fact is, they did have the authority, and this was a public health emergency, and they were right to be concerned. So as the Inspector General's report detailed, this and other agencies can and should step in when the agencies they're monitoring aren't doing their jobs properly. And in this case, they just weren't. They just weren't.
We are speaking with Anna Clark, author of The Poison City, Flint's Water, and American Urban Tragedy, here on the Left of Lansing podcast. All right, so like I said, this is such a frustrating and upsetting story, but I've got to believe, though, that I want to believe that there's some good that can come out of it. First of all, Anna, who would you say were some of the real heroes in this story that got it out there in the open for everybody to know?
Oh, that's a lovely question. Well, first and foremost, I want to give due credit to community organizers in Flint, of which there are many, who were making themselves visible in every way possible well before anybody was paying attention to them, frankly. And it is only because of them that any of us are talking about it nowadays. Like, they were very savvy in how they were mapping the rising crisis and how they were reaching out to outside experts to help validate them when they realized that they themselves were not being believed. So they come first. Second of all, Miguel del Toro, who was that guy at the EPA office in Chicago, has been a real hero. He did the right thing and helped get this out there. There was Kurt Guyette, who was a former Alt Weekly reporter who had gotten a job doing some reporting for the ACLU of Michigan. He was the very first journalist to break the news of Miguel del Toro's report, and his reporting totally changed the journalism narrative, basically, about this water crisis and helped put the state in a position to ask to be facing harder and tougher questions. There was Elin Betanzo and Mona Hanna Atisha. They were high school friends, one who became a water expert, one who became a pediatrician working in Flint. And between the two of them, they played a critical role in showing that not only was Flint's water having higher levels of lead, but that lead was getting into the bodies of little small children. Absolutely pivotal step in turning this around. And of course, there was a lot of researchers and scientists and other things like that that helped work with Flint residents to get more and better data to counter what the state was claiming was true about their water. So the good news is, Flint's a despairing story in many ways, but there are a lot of good people who did good things.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I just want to have you bring this point up real quick, because we're talking about children that were poisoned by lead. We won't know for years how this will affect many of them. Is that correct?
Yeah, the way lead works, you're most vulnerable to it when you're an infant, maybe, like drinking formula with tap water or that has a lot of lead in it, or a little child who's exposed to it. And the reason people are so concerned about lead is because once you're exposed to it, it gets into your bloodstream and is eventually absorbed in your bones and brain. And for these little people who have developing bodies and brains, that it can play a really significant role in affecting your health, your behavior, your brain development, all that. Like you said, a lot of that doesn't really show up until they get a little bit older. Some people aren't going to be, people are affected differently. Some people who are exposed to a lot of lead may grow up and never show any serious symptoms of lead poisoning, especially because thanks to a lot of recovery efforts that have shown up in Flint lately. That's great. But I think it's fair to assume that a lot of them will, unfortunately. I think that's part of the consequences here, that the problem with lead poisoning is that it is incurable. That's it. It gets in you and it stays in you, and it affects you in ways that you can't reverse. The thing we got to do as a society to protect our children, to protect our communities, is to get rid of the lead. And certainly in the water, but also, of course, in the remaining lead paint that's still in our communities, and the lead that gotten into our soil and after decades of leaded fuel. Lead is one of the world's best known neurotoxins. We should never have put it everywhere. Unfortunately, those who came before us did. So now we got to deal with it. I don't think we can, as Flint shows, pretending it's not there is not going to do us any favors.
Right. And I would say that one of your sub themes to this book is that would, of course, take lots of money to fix our infrastructure. And Flint, like many other cities across America, are dealing with infrastructure problems because of a lack of funding through the last few decades. Nothing will change unless we decide to reinvest again. Is that right?
That's right. I think even setting aside lead, a lot of the pipes in our drinking water system are old and crumbling. They break all the time. We hear a lot of news of main breaks. Some of them have been as old as 80 years or more in a lot of our communities, and not just in poor, disinvested cities, but in wealthy communities too. And water infrastructure is just not a thing that has been a super high priority. We've been kind of in a position of only dealing with it when there's a problem, like when there's a leak, when there's a break. And the fact is, sooner or later, we're going to have to replace these pipes anyway. We may as well do it sooner, I think that would probably benefit all of us. But yeah, it's a tough conversation to have. They're complicated projects, they're expensive projects, they're long-term projects. It does require some vision. We've seen in Michigan how even dealing with roads, which everybody can see is crumbling right before us, is tough to find any agreement on there. I think with water infrastructure, it's only harder just because we don't see it every day. We don't deal with the problems every day, so we think. But I'd like to think that of all things that could bring people together in these very polarized times, getting these basic systems to work, I think that could be the thing, right? Like, yes. Like who's anti-clean water? Like, who's anti-driving road? Let's just work together to get these things functional, you know? It'd be great. I think this would be a point of agreement.
That's a great place where we should probably end this interview. Anna Clark, author of The Poison City, Flint Water, and The American Urban Tragedy. Anna, how can people find you online and get a copy of your book?
Oh, well, that's a nice question. Well, online, I'm at annaclark.net. If anybody has any questions, feel free to reach out to me through there. I'm happy to talk about this stuff more. With the books available wherever books are sold, Of course, I encourage people, if they can, to pick up the book at their local independent bookseller, who are wonderful civic institutions, and people who want to get the book, getting it there would make me very happy.
All right. Well, very well. Anna Clark, thank you so much for being on the Left of Lansing podcast, and I hope that you would consider coming back on sometime in the future.
It'd be a joy. I really enjoyed this conversation. Thank you.
It's progressivism with passion. It's the Left of Lansing podcast, where Pat Johnston shines a light on Michigan's progressive movement. Contact Pat at leftoflansing@gmail.com. And don't forget to visit leftoflansing.com for more news and information. Now, back to Pat Johnston.
Thanks once again to Anna Clark for being on the podcast this week. That was a great interview. I'll leave a link of her blog on my blog, leftoflansing.com. That's where you can also find this week's podcast as well as previous podcasts. Time now for the Left of Lansing Last Call. An extreme right-wing U.S. district judge this week temporarily suspended Michigan's new gay-friendly adoption policy. According to the Bridge Magazine's Jonathan Oosting, District Judge Robert Jonker is allowing litigation against Michigan Democratic Attorney General Dana Nessel's settlement, which banned adoption agencies that receive state contracts from discriminating against gay couples who want to adopt kids. A couple of these adoption agencies cited their religious beliefs as to why they don't want to adhere to this new rule. Judge Jonker, in his opinion, said, and this is according again to The Bridge, what St. Vincent, and that is one of the parties in this case, what St. Vincent has not done and will not do is give up its traditional Catholic belief that marriage, as instituted by God, is for one man and one woman. He said that Nessel put the charity in a position of either giving up its belief or giving up its contract with the state. It was a 32-page opinion, by the way. He also said that kind of targeted attack on a sincerely held religious belief is what calls for strict scrutiny in this case and supports entry of a preliminary injunction preserving the status quo while this case is being fully litigated. And in another order, Jonker prohibited the state from terminating or suspending contracts with St. Vincent Catholic Charities because of its protected religious exercise while this case continues. You know, I find it strange, very, very strange, that many of these judges never actually turn to the Bible to see whether or not these agencies citing religious freedom are actually adhering to said religion. As I tweeted last night, I'd like to know where Christ ever denounced gay marriage, the ability for gay couples to adopt, or anything about homosexuality. I mean, if you oppose the right for gay couples to provide a loving home for children, again, children, what happened to you pro-lifers out there? Gay couples are just trying to provide a loving home for children. So if you oppose that, which religion again do you follow? Because I'm not familiar with that religion. It's certainly not Christianity to me.
You're listening to the Left of Lansing podcast. The music you are hearing is by Wanderbeats. To hear the latest project, check out Space Leopard on your favorite streaming site. Now back to my favorite progressive voice, Pat Johnston.
that is going to do it for this edition of the Left of Lansing podcast. Remember, if you'd like to contact me, very simple, leftoflansing@gmail.com. I'm also on Twitter. That's @leftoflansing. Plus, you can find me on the Facebook. Special thanks again to my guest this week, Anna Clark. And again, you can check out her blog on my blog, leftoflansing.com, which again is where this week's podcast will be posted along with all of the other previous podcasts. Everybody, please remember, as I tell you each and every time, stay engaged, stay informed. They want you to become discouraged. They want you to tune out, because if you tune out, then you won't vote. That's exactly what Michigan Republican Senate Majority Leader Mike Shirkey wants you to do. He wants you to tune out because, as he said, the more people who vote here in Michigan, the less it helps his interests. Stay engaged, stay in the fight, and remember, take the battle to them. Thank you, Michigan!
The Left of Lansing podcast was produced by Pat Johnston, written by Pat Johnston, researched by Pat Johnston. Just kidding, this thing isn't researched. And broadcasted by Pat Johnston. Technical assistance provided by the wonderful Dr. Heather. And don't forget to visit leftoflansing.com for more news and information and Pat's musical taste, if you can handle it. Thanks again for listening to the Left of Lansing podcast.